This morning we'll study the life of Moses as it is given in the sermon of Stephen, or the defense of Stephen before the council in Jerusalem. In order for us to see where we are in our study this morning, I want us to look at chapter 6, an accusation that is made against Stephen in verse 14. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered unto us. This is the charge that has been brought against Stephen. He has spoke blasphemous words against Moses and against God. And he has spoken against this holy place, that is the temple. And he has spoken against the law. And he has said that Jesus Christ is going to destroy this place, that is the temple, and he's going to change the customs, that is the traditions, which Moses delivered unto us. Now that's the charge. And in his defense, or in his apology, I believe that Stephen tries to establish, by giving an historical account of Israel and the building of the temple, not simply the giving of the law, but the building of the temple, I think Stephen is trying to prove and show to these people that the temple was not necessary from the viewpoint of continuing the worship of God on earth. And that indeed the temple had never been necessary. The tabernacle in the wilderness was put into physical form by Moses as he followed the explicit direction of Almighty God to show on the earth that which existed in heaven. The tabernacle was not a shadow and a prophecy of the church. The tabernacle was a shadow of things that already existed in heaven. Now you can read that in the book of Hebrews. The tabernacle was a shadow of a thing that already existed. Not the shadow of something that would exist. Now let's notice the statements of Stephen concerning Moses, because Moses is a very important part of his defense, because it is said that he preaches that Jesus of Nazareth is going to come and he's going to change the customs of Moses. He's going to change the way we've been doing things for hundreds of years. He's going to change the things that Moses taught us to do, and that's really true. Jesus didn't intend for the Jews to continue the program of Jewish sacrifices. It was a true accusation. And I think in God's plan, he intended to destroy the temple. And he intended to destroy the temple worship, because there was no longer any need for it from the viewpoint of God's plan for the evangelization of the world through the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Not only was it in God's plan to destroy it, it was necessary. It was like the life of John the Baptist being taken, because too many people had identified themselves with him. There were people who were loyal to him, and Jesus said in his statements, and John realized that John the Baptist would have to be taken off the scene, that he must decrease, and Jesus must increase. And I think the temple had to be taken off the scene so that the eyes of the world would be taken from it and fixed on the church, which is the place of worship and the place of God's spiritual habitation in the world today. In verse 30, we see the beginning of Moses' ministry. Stephen has given an account of the sons of the patriarchs being carried into Egyptian captivity. In verse 17, he states, "But when the time of the promise drew nigh, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt." This was God's catalyst. This was God's fuse to grow and multiply the children of Israel in Egypt until the Egyptians looked at them and said, "They're going to become more numerous than we are, and we've got to do something about these Israelites." So they began to burden them. And when they began to burden them, the Bible tells us that God saw their afflictions and God heard their groans, and he sent Moses as a deliverer. It's a passing interest, to say the least, that the catalyst for the church, the fuse, the cap, if you please, that exploded the church at Jerusalem seems to be its rapid growth and increase. That seemed to be this unprecedented multiplication of disciples seemed to have set in motion the things that got the church in trouble, so that it was eventually disseminated and scattered. It was growth in the land of Egypt that eventually was used to get them to cry out to God for deliverance and follow the deliverer when God sent Moses into the land. The Bible tells us that when Moses was 40 years old, he wanted to be identified with his people. And it came into his heart to be identified with them and to visit the brethren, the children of Israel. And the Bible tells us that they rejected any overtures that he made. He supposed that his brethren would understand how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. That's in verse 25. They didn't accept Moses, and you can understand why. He'd been in the court of the Egyptian Pharaoh. He was learned and schooled and trained in all their ways. He was not by training an Israelite, but an Egyptian. He had the smell of Pharaoh's house about him, and they really wanted to have nothing to do with him. And so the Bible tells us that in his anger against the Egyptians who were oppressing his brethren, he slew one and then fled for his life. And the Bible tells us that he was in the land of Midian, where he had two sons, and when 40 years were expired, there appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai an angel of the Lord in a flame of fire in a bush. So it was 40 years, the age of 40, he identified himself as a servant and brother, a servant of Jehovah God and a brother of the Israelites. He chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. This was Moses' choice at 40 years old. They rejected him as a deliverer. And the Bible tells us he fled to the land of Midian, where he had two sons. 40 years later, the Bible tells us that God spoke to him. Now, oftentimes, as we look at the lives of these men, such as Moses, the details that are mentioned in the Bible, if we're not careful, tend to give us the impression that these things happened very quickly. That is, one following another in short succession of time. that all of this happened in a very brief period of time, but really what we're studying now is the whole life of Moses. He was 40 years old when he first made his choice. He was 40 years old when God called him and told him by the burning bush, using signs and wonders, that he wanted him to go and to be the one who would deliver the children of Israel. God said in verse 32, I am the God of thy fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, I think it was necessary that God identify himself. You remember, Moses was not schooled in the ways of the Israelites. He was schooled in the ways of the Egyptians. He obviously learned a great deal in these 40 years in the wilderness about God and God's ways. But God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I am a holy God. Put your shoes off from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. And I'll just take a moment to say that I think we have digressed to our own harm when we have chosen to become familiar with God, when we have chosen to become on first name basis with God, and that we have chosen to make God one of our buddies rather than our Heavenly Father, that we have lost our respect for God, that we have lost through familiarity in many, many, many ways, though not scriptural ways, through a fleshly familiarity, we have lost the essence of awe and of greatness that belongs to God and His Son Jesus Christ. And people today speak in unscriptural terms to describe the relationship to God. They sing love songs to Him that are not differentiated from the viewpoint of words and sentiment from the love songs that are sung in beer halls and sung on jukeboxes. They just sort of change the words a little bit, and there's no reverence for God. And people glory in this kind of fleshly familiarity. We have elevated ourselves and we have dragged God down from the stars and His place of holiness. We have dragged God down to the gutters and sewers of America and the world, not to help us as God, but so that we might influence Him as a fallible creature. Sort of get on drinking terms with God and break down this barrier of holiness that divides and separates the God of the universe from the humans of the world. God wanted Moses to know that He was a holy God, that He was to be reverenced and feared and respected. The Lord said, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place where thou standest is holy ground. I have seen the affliction of my people, which is in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning and come down to deliver them. Now come, I will send thee unto Egypt. These people had been in Egypt for a long time, but they were not conscious of being out of place until they began to suffer affliction. And then they began to cry out and groan to God for deliverance. They were so comfortable, and they were so esteemed, and they were so respected and so protected by the influence of Joseph that they were perfectly willing to stay in the land of Goshen, to reap their bountiful harvest and to enjoy the physical things of Egypt, the cucumbers, the leeks, the garlic. and perhaps even to play footsie with the false gods that they had not heretofore known about. God's people ought to curse the day that we become comfortable in this world, that it no longer vexes our spirit, that it no longer troubles our soul to hear the language they use and to be exposed to the ideas that they espouse and are to be a part of the system that so obviously seeks not only to destroy the influence of God, but to destroy the influence of His people. We have become comfortable and self-satisfied in the prosperity and the glory of being Christians in a Christian nation, so-called. God said, I've seen the affliction of my people, I've heard their groanings. And God said, now come, I will send thee to Egypt to be a ruler and a deliverer. You know, one of the Israelites had said when he thrust Moses away, as Moses set about to settle a quarrel between two of his brethren, who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? And I guess Moses could have said, God did. You know, oftentimes people ask, who gave you the right to get up there in the pulpit and preach what you preach? God did. You know, who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? God did. That's what Moses could have said, because that's truly what God did. He made Moses a ruler and a judge and a deliverer of the people. And obviously, the people had the idea that this is the mission that God wanted Moses to be involved in. And this was even true before Moses left the land of Egypt the first time when he was 40 years old. It's a rather startling thought that Moses came to the Israelites and offered himself to be their judge and their deliverer and their ruler and to lead them out of the land of Egypt. And obviously they laughed at him, they mocked him, and refused his leadership. And this perplexed Moses, evidently. He was really unsure of what was going to happen. But God allowed their suffering to become more intense. And in that circumstance, they were willing to accept Moses, whom the Bible tells us in verse 36, brought them out and showed them signs and wonders. And how many times do we see how God uses signs and wonders to affirm who He is and the mission that He has given to people? Moses then in verse 37 wrote of Jesus. And Stephen says, this is that Moses which said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren like unto me. Him shall you hear, that is, you must hear him. This is he that was in the church. Now that means the assembly in the wilderness, not a church as a New Testament church, which the angel which spake to him in the Mount Sinai and with our fathers, who received the living oracles to give unto us, to whom our fathers would not obey, and thrust him from them, and in their hearts turned back again into Egypt. Isn't it strange that after having received the living oracles, that is, after having received the written word of God, the Bible tells us that they refused and rejected him. This was their response to the ministry of Moses. They would not accept his work. They thrust him from them. Now notice. And in their hearts turned back to Egypt. You know, the Israelites, after having been delivered by the blood, and after having been baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the Red Sea, they never went back into Egyptian bondage, because that was a type of spiritual deliverance. And the Bible uses it such, that is, they were under the blood, they were baptized unto Moses, they were immersed. They never again went under Egyptian bondage, for had they, it would have destroyed the type that God wanted us to see, and it would have presented in type apostasy, how that once saved you could so sin as to be lost and be brought back into bondage again. But God never allowed that to happen to the Israelites, though the Bible tells us in their heart, they preferred Egypt with all of its suffering and with all of its idolatry. They preferred Egypt to the fellowship of God in the wilderness. And the heart of God's people rarely changes. And I think there are many of God's people today whose heads and bodies are in the wilderness with God's people, but their hearts are in Egypt. And they'd much prefer to be eating the leeks and the garlic and the cucumbers of Egypt than to being fed with the manna of God's holy word. It is more acceptable to them. It is more appealing to them. They prefer it. It's so difficult to understand why people would rather sit at the garbage can of the world and eat its refuse than to sit at the table of God, enjoy the pure food that gives life and strength and sustenance, that leads and directs us to everything that's holy and right and good. And yet, if given a choice, many of God's people are like the Israelites. Their hearts are in Egypt. And because of this, the Bible tells us that they resorted to idolatry. In verses 40 and 41, the Bible tells us, "And they made a calf in those days and offered sacrifice unto the idol and rejoiced in the works of their own hands. Then God turned and gave them up to worship the host of heaven. As it is written in the book of the prophets, O ye house of Israel, have ye offered to me slain beasts and sacrifices by the space of 40 years in the wilderness? Yes, you took up the tabernacle of Moloch and the star of your God, Remphan, figures which you made to worship them. And he said, I will carry you away beyond Babylon." It is not a strange response of God when people's hearts long for Egypt and they turn from the true God to idols, to serve and to honor the idols that they have adopted and appropriated into their lives. It is not a strange thing then for us to know that God turns, that God gives them up, and they are carried away beyond Babylon. It's such a tearful and woeful circumstance that so many of our people have longed in their heart for Egypt, involved themselves in idol worship, and now find themselves beyond Babylon. And were I to describe the living place of many of God's people today, I would not describe it as being in the land of promise. I would not describe it as being in the land of bondage. But I would describe their existence as a miserable existence beyond Babylon. And the Bible tells us that Israel had a witness. In verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness. God has never left his people without a witness. There has never been a time when God's people existed without witness. And I think it was a witness that, as I said earlier, reflected that circumstance which existed and waited in heaven. Moses, that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen. Now, these are the instructions that Moses had. See that you make it just exactly like I represent it to you, because I want you to see that it represents something, and I think it represented a circumstance that waited in heaven. And every time a Jew came into that tabernacle in the wilderness and the priest functioned, blood was shed. It prefigured that time when the Son of God, sinless and innocent, would be sacrificed on the cross of Calvary, and his blood then would be taken by himself up into the very presence of God. And there in that circumstance, pictured in the tabernacle, in that true reality of things, he would offer once for all his own blood for the sins of the people. And that's what the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness was, a constant reminder of the efficacy of the blood of the coming one. That was its purpose, to demonstrate and show continually that without blood it is impossible to please him, and that when blood offerings are made in faith, God accepts them. But then the Bible tells us that David, who had found favor with God, that David then, the Bible tells us, decided that he would build God a palace, a place where God might dwell. Now, this tabernacle, which also our fathers that came after brought in with Jesus, now that's really Joshua, into the possession of the Gentiles, whom God drave out before the face of our fathers, unto the days of David. That is, the tabernacle of witness, Joshua brought it with the children of Israel into this land of promise, and it abode there, the tabernacle of witness did, until the days of David. Who found favor before God and desired to find a tabernacle for the God of Jacob. Now, these people were good Jewish historians, and they knew that David had not been allowed to build a temple because he was a bloody man. In verse 47, the Bible tells us, but Solomon built him an house. Now, here's the point of the message that Stephen preached. You remember he had been accused of what? Of saying that Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, would destroy the temple and change the customs and traditions that Moses had taught the Jews. Here's Stephen's principal point. Howbeit, the Most High dwelleth not in temples made with hands, as saith the prophet. Heaven is my throne, and earth is my footstool. What house will you build me, saith the Lord, or what is the place of my rest? Hath not my hand made all these things? You see, these people evidently, when they heard what Stephen had said, that Jesus had said, they panicked. And they said, this is a blasphemous speech that we've heard, because everyone knows that we couldn't exist that God couldn't exist without this temple. That without it, we'd be barren of God's presence. That without it, we'd be without direction. Without it, we would be just another nation of people. For it is the temple that separates and sets us aside from all the other nations of the world. Stephen, in reality, is saying, God doesn't have to have this temple as a place of rest. It's not where God spends the night in order to refresh himself so they can get up and run the world in the morning. Why, you can't contain God in a temple. He sort of indicates that God would have preferred to have had the tabernacle of witness where it was portable and moved among men. Just thought. But David aspired to build this great temple. God let them because that's what kings did. Perhaps in the true plan of God, it was Messiah who was to build the temple when Israel accepted him as their king and as their legitimate ruler. Then Messiah would have built the temple. Perhaps that's true. Perhaps that's why it speaks of the idea that he is of his father David, a king. The temple will be restored. Perhaps David got a little anxious to build. But the Jews had said, God lives here. This is sacred. And this is holy. God said, I don't live there. I don't domicile there. That's not where I sleep at night and then go out to do the things I do in the daytime. Why? Because God dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. And Stephen is challenging them and he's saying, well, suppose it is true. What harm will it do if this temple is torn down? God doesn't live here. You're not vacating God. You're not making him a homeless vagrant. Because God doesn't live here anymore. This is not his home. He's got another place to dwell now. That is in the ecclesia, in the ecclesia, in the assembly, where men and women truly born again of God and truly immersed scripturally congregate together in purpose. And as they congregate together, then the Spirit of the living God dwells in and among them as he dwells nowhere else on earth. And that is a portable temple, a portable tabernacle, again out in the wilderness where men and women can find and touch God in a very special way. And he can be with us all as he could never be with us were he in person or were there just one place on earth where he chose to dwell. And all over our world this day, men and women who have been saved and men and women who have been scripturally immersed and congregate together, whether in the tropical extremes of India where our missionaries labor, whether in South America, North America, Alaska, the lavish, deserted cathedrals of the East, the modern, contemporary cathedrals of glass in the West, the millions of dollars that have been spent on buildings, none of these impress God. None of these beckon to God in themselves. Just like the tabernacle in the wilderness, there God came among his people. And he was their God, and they were his people. We must never say that God dwells in this building. God doesn't dwell in this building, but he dwells among his people. We could move, and as we move, the Spirit of God would move. indicating the fact that we, as God's people, are out in the world to serve Him in the world, to be witnesses of Him in the world, as the tabernacle was a witness to Israel. There's nothing wrong with a permanent house of worship. We must never worship the house of worship, but the God who has saved us and called us. I imagine Stephen just didn't have it within him as a Jew to say, this is nothing. This is going to be a pile of stones. Jesus was right. He will change the customs that Moses taught us. They'll all been fulfilled in Him. They'll all be done away with. And this building, this temple, it will be destroyed, just like He said. Because there's really no need for it anymore. It's not necessary. It's obsolescent. And indeed it is. And then Stephen said the things that got him stoned to death. And we'll be studying that next Sunday morning, God willing.